back to the Distressed Pro Professional podcast series. Today, I'm really happy to have Warren Kirschenbaum on the line, whom I've spoken with in the past. I've known Warren now for a couple of years, and he has some interesting specialties in the field of law. And so I've asked him today to come talk to us about assembling a fund. I've asked specifically to talk about how to assemble a private equity fund for the purpose of buying notes. However, what we're going to talk about today would apply to buying any kind of assets. So just a quick bio on Warren. Warren Kirschenbaum, he's president of Cherry Tree Group, LLC. He's an experienced transactional real estate and business attorney. Specializes in tax credit syndication, arbitrage, and private equity, as well as creating distressed asset investing platforms, structuring private equity funds, loan workouts, short sale and foreclosure purchases, brownfields, and renewable energy tax credit transactions. He was educated at the University of the Warren. How am I going to say that? What is it? Is it Witwatersrand? <Wittersund?
laughs> Close. Yeah, Witwatersrand.
Okay. New England School of Law, New York University School of Law. He's got numerous professional affiliations that you can find at his website, cherrytree-group.com. And before I butcher anything else on your page, Warren, thanks very much for being on the call and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Correct. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's great to have you back. I think you were one of my first guests quite a while ago, and I think to have you back now for this is timely. There's just such a surge in interest in notes and in distressed assets generally, and with the data that I'm looking at, I think we're really expecting to see more stuff get released over the next, 12, 24, maybe even 36 months or so. And so folks, are getting positioned for that. And so this is a very timely, I think it's a very important call. For me personally, I've become more interested in this. As you know, I've been very transactional, work for banks, and I do a lot of disposition work. But I have had a lot of folks with money talking to me about, wanting me to help them get connected. So I have a personal interest here, too, just in how we would do this. So we've got a great outline. I look forward to working through it with you, and I'll ask you some questions along the way. You want to just dive right into it, or is there anything you want to say before we get to the meat of it?
No, we can dive right into it.
Okay. So help us understand what type of a legal structure do we have to have in order to have investors what do I have to have investors give me money that I'm then going to invest on their behalf?
Okay. Basically, what you're looking to do in this type of situation is to raise a pool of money whereby you're going to either invest in a number of assets that are either identified or to be identified. So the investors are going to invest in one or more persons who have the pedigree or track record that they are hoping to see. And so what tends to happen is that an entity will be set up, and usually it's either a limited partnership or it's a limited liability company. What happens on the limited partnership side is that you are treated as a corporate entity, but for tax purposes you looked at it as a partnership by the IRS, but you need to have an entity involved that runs the daily operation of the fund, which becomes the corporate general partner. And so you have a corporate general partner owning a very small equity interest, and the majority, if not all, of the equity interest is owned by the limited partners, who tend to be the investors.
Okay.
On the other side, there's a limited liability company, which gives you the the same flow through tax advantages, but the investors would just be members of the limited liability company. So it's a little little simpler structure, and there are advantages and disadvantages of each, and it just depends on the deal and the preferences of the principals and the investors.
Okay. So is this applicable? Is this a state-by-state sort of a thing, or is this something that applies generally no matter where, you know, anybody is? Who, you know, we have listeners across the country.
It applies generally. It's the same structure.
Okay.
Wherever, in whichever state you are, but the fund's principals will tend to form the entity in either the state in which they are based or doing business or acquiring the assets. So if that, for instance, is New York or California, then it might be a California entity. It is possible that it might be that they choose a neutral entity or one that has advantages that they believe are there for either from a litigation standpoint, that the corporate law is more advanced, like a Delaware or Nevada. So it can be structured anywhere, and it's traditionally the same structure.
Okay. And so at what point would you recommend, or at what point do people usually establish an entity? Would you do it before you, I mean, do you need, I guess what I'm getting to is, do you need to have this in place before you start looking for money?
I would advise it, yes.
Okay.
Technically, what could happen is that the investors could invest, and it would go into an escrow account held by a professional, whether that's a third party or an attorney in the deal, and then it would be released at some point to the fund itself based on how the deal is structured and what the rules and requirements are in the offering documents for the release of that money. But I have also seen that the money would go directly into the fund itself, and in that case you would have to have the entity set up. But I would always recommend that the entity gets set up prior to looking for the funding.
Okay. Did I cut you off when I just start interjecting and running over you with my own questions? Were you on a track there, or you want me to keep going?
I think it's fine. Does it sound?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
okay.
Fine.
Or
okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Doesn't yeah. Totally.
No.
Okay. Okay. So whether I'm investing in one asset or multiple assets doesn't matter, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
It's that the fund concept originated out of people, developers, or whoever, or purchasers of assets, that there has traditionally always been a market where somebody with a particular asset would potentially go out and find an equity partner to come in and provide the initial funding for that, and the remainder of it would be debt funding. But that's different, because there's a particular asset that's been identified, and the investor could do due diligence on that asset, so they know what they're getting. The fund concept is different, because essentially you are being asked, if you are an investor, to invest your money into a pool of funds together with other investors, whereby the fund's principals or the management of the fund is going to then go out and purchase what is then undisclosed assets. You know what type of class they are. In this case, we're talking about notes or financial instruments, but you don't have a specific portfolio, a specific identification. So
right.
That's where the risk factors need to be fleshed out, and that's where investors need most of the information, or the trust factor comes into play.
So if I'm putting together the fund, if I'm, you know, assembling the money and sourcing the notes, or, you know, whatever other assets they are, What options would I have for, in terms of how I set up my own compensation, are fees, equity, or, what does that look like, or what are my parameters to consider?
Okay. A lot of times the principal in the fund will retain some equity in the fund. For instance, if it's a limited liability company, the principal sets it up and at that point is the sole shareholder, and when the investors invest in, they will be taking upwards of 80%, maybe even 90 or more percent of the equity. So mm-hmm. I think if a principal retains some equity, it's usually in the range of the 5 to 10% amount.
Mm-hmm.
20% seems to be on the high end.
Mm-hmm.
The other ways that they get compensated is with a management agreement. The principals, and in a deal such as this, where you acquiring notes, You would assume you're dealing with a principal that has a relationship with one or many financial institutions, and so they've either done business with them before, they have a track record, the financial institution knows that they can come up with the funding and close the deal. So what they're saying now is we just need a larger funding base. So they will be running that deal in the sense of they're sourcing the assets, negotiating, closing on them. They're managing the funds that come in and out and running the day-to-day activity. And they may have a management agreement which pays them a certain guaranteed amount or an annual percentage fee or things like that. Where there's work that needs to be done, if the asset needs to be rehabilitated or repositioned to be placed back on the market for resale or rent, if it's one of those type of deals, then you might need an entity that's going to be doing that work. That entity sometimes is affiliated with the principals, and there's fees that get charged to the fund in that way. So the principals will either take some equity, get a management or have affiliated corporations that they own or run, extracting fees from the fund. And I think the way the structure will work for each particular fund depends on how the pro forma numbers come out.
Okay.
Investors in a particular fund may either be promised or be looking for a return in the 12% range or the 16% range. And if that's the case, then how this compensation work will have to be scaled up or down to meet those objectives.
So typically when a fund, after you have started to, well, maybe it's not after. How should I ask this question? What level of involvement do you typically see that the sort of silent partners have, if any, in the actual decision-making process after you've been funded? And I guess what I'm asking is, okay, so I've laid out the criteria for, what I'm looking for assets, what kind of a return I think I'm going to be able to provide you. You've now given me your money, and I'm working with it. What other involvement or input, what control does the silent partner or the limited partner have at that point?
Usually not a lot, Brett.
Okay.
Usually it's a passive role.
Yeah.
You can't see in a situation where an investor is either capitalizing the fund to a large extent, making a big capital contribution, that they may negotiate up front that they get some kind of board seat or advisory board seat or something like that. But for the most part, it's a passive investment where you're ceding control over to the fund principals. They're going to run with this and report to you as an investor, either quarterly or annually. So it's not much involvement on the part of the investor.
Okay. All right. So let's get on to sort of the second section that we had that we'd looked at for this, which is what rules or regulations do I need to be aware of when I'm marketing my fund or soliciting for investors for it?
Okay, that's a great question. This essentially, it is a private offering. And so you fall under the securities laws, and there are state securities laws known as the Blue Sky Laws and the federal securities laws, which, of course, have garnered more attention, and that's the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission. Mm-hmm. When you're doing a private offering, you're exempt from registration with the federal and the state securities regulators, so long as you follow the rules of that exemption. It's a Section 4.2 private offering exemption, and there's specific rules within the 1933 Securities Act which deal with the requirements, such as the size of the offering you can have, whether it's going to be an offering within a particular period of time, like a 12-month period, whether the financial statements need to be certified or audited, and things of that nature. So the offering documents will be drafted in order to meet and comply with these rules. And basically it's a disclosure type document whereby you are, number one, disclosing to the investors the particulars of the deal, the risks of the deal, which is very important. And that kind of touches on what we talked about before. If you're dealing in notes, there might be several risks, and these will differ from deal to deal based on the structure, the size of the deal. It also depends on how much money is being raised and whether the fund can be begun if not all that money is raised, because if financial projections are being made based on a certain amount of dollars coming in, and then the fund can be begin operations on less than that amount, then each investor's risk is increased. So the documents need to make these financial projections, tell the investors how this deal is going to be structured. And like we mentioned before, if there are affiliated entities that are going to be earning money from the fund and they are owned by the principals, that's something that should be disclosed, the management agreement, things of that nature. Then on the other side, the investors themselves need to be a particular type of investor. And mm-hmm. They have a designation in the statute as either accredited or non-accredited.
Sure.
And for accredited investors, there's a particular set of parameters based on your qualification, could be your knowledge and expertise, the amount of income that you earn per year, net worth, whether you're an individual or corporation, and things of that nature. The disclosure requirements are heightened if there's a non-accredited investor versus if there's an accredited investor. And there's also mm-hmm. a limit based on which rules that you follow as to how many non-accredited investors you can have in an offering. So there's a number of rules that you have to follow both in drafting and in soliciting and soliciting the investors and in bringing in the funds. There's general solicitation rules because the offering needs to be made only to specific types of people, and we could discuss this for a long time. You'll just have to stop me.
Well, let me ask a few. Let me ask a few pointed questions. So, I'm reasonably familiar with the term accredited investor. I think last time I heard anything about it, it was something like you had to have a minimum net worth of, I forget what it was, like a million or something, and you had to have had net income of like $250,000 a year for 3 years or something. Am I in the ballpark with that in terms of who that is?
Yes, it's a Section 501 of this Regulation D.
Okay.
The way that we tend to deal with this is to create an investor questionnaire,
mm-hmm.
which goes out to the investors, which mimics the requirements of the statute, and we're asking people to certify as to whether or not they fall within certain categories. And
mm-hmm.
you're right, if you're an individual, is your net worth more than $1 million? Was your income for the past 2 years at least $200,000 as an individual, or if you're married, $300,000?
Okay.
But then also, do you expect it'll be at that level for the next 2 years?
Okay.
If you're a corporation, do you have an asset in excess of $5 million, and so on and so forth? It's assumed that if you meet these requirements, then you have the financial ability to invest in these types of deals.
Okay.
And basically what it is it's illiquid, and I think that's something that should be stressed in the risk factors in several places in these deals, because traditionally for the fund to work, the money's coming in, but it's only going to be distributed or returned to investors at the end of a term.
Okay.
And that term, there'll be a holding period of 3 years or 5 years or 7 years or whatever the business plan shows that a full cycle is needed in order to make this business work. So as an investor, you'd have to, one, be able to invest this money and have it not affect your life or your business operations. And two, I think you have to be able to be in the position that if the investment was lost completely, it also wouldn't affect you.
Okay.
So, and I think this is an important consideration, because I think this is where the lawyers come in, because you draft the documents, but then you need to make sure that your clients are soliciting the right type of people, because you can have people out there with assets who are not sophisticated. If it's an inheritance or something like that,
sure.
you may have a situation where there's assets, but investing in an illiquid private equity deal would be completely inappropriate.
Right. So if I'm out there looking for real money, and putting some of that together, and then my cousin Larry wants to get in, you know, with $10,000 or something, I not only is it obviously dangerous for him, but accepting his money would even sort of restrict or dictate some more complications in assembling the other money. Is that a fair statement?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Because clearly we're talking about funds that may have accredited investors, but for the most part, at the level that I deal with, we're not dealing with sophisticated financial institutions who are investing in hundreds of millions of dollars or $500 million funds.
Right.
So at this level, yes, I think you have to be concerned, and some of these concerns are just are risk-based, legal-based, and business-based. So
mm-hmm.
from a business perspective, if you're going to raise a $3 or $5 million fund...
Yeah, that's just exactly what I was going to ask, that range, yep.
Okay, so and you're taking $10,000 from Cousin Larry...
Yeah.
You may end up having hundreds of investors, and like we talked about earlier, they are passive, but they're going to want to know what's going on and get a
sure.
report orderlies, or and so this is going to be a major undertaking for the fund to be able to satisfy and communicate properly with its investors. The other consideration is if you're setting those limits too low at, let's say, the $10,000, then you get a different type of investor versus if you're saying for your fund it's a minimum investment of $50,000 or $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
So the higher you set it, there will be a difference in the audience that you're speaking to or attracting.
Okay.
It's possible. And why I said yes and no is because the cousin Larry is, however, important to us, because if you were the fund principal, and I'm an investor, the thing is, you're coming to me and saying, invest in this pool, and I'm going to have discretion over it. You don't know what investments I'm going to make.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of trust me. Then one of the thoughts going through an investor's mind is, well, tell me you've got some of your own money in there. Or at least if you haven't, you've got some family or friends who think you're smart enough that they'll put their money in.
I see.
And I'm not the first person you're coming to. So,
right.
So you kind of want cousin Larry's money in there, and you don't.
Okay. All right. And so we've talked a little bit about who you know, can invest, or, you know, what that means and how that works. I want to talk a little bit about finding people. I mean, you know, I have obviously been in the business for a little while, so I know a lot of people and can pick up the phone and that kind of thing. But if I'm not maybe as well connected, and I've got a good plan, or maybe I know some bankers, I have good sources that I've set up, I know I can get product that would be attractive, and I want to go out and start marketing myself or marketing my fund, or, you know, to solicit, then, you know, what are my restrictions? Can I have can I send a mailing to, you know, all the dentists in a 50-mile area and have them, you know, and go do a town hall type, you know, meeting? Can I run an ad on the internet and, you know, have people visit a sales page where they complete a form to find out more information? Like, sort of, what are the mechanics of how all that would work, and what would and I know I just asked you probably two big questions in one breath that are not the same, but if you could just sort of lay that out a little bit, how that would work if you're working with people who aren't they aren't today the kind of people where you would pick up the phone and just tell them that you're raising capital.
That's another great question. I think that a lot of fund principals that have this idea, they speak informally with people who say, sounds like a good idea. I might be an investor in that, but that and actually being an investor and putting up the capital is two very different conversations. So I think a lot of people approach this with the idea, not much, not that they haven't thought it through, but they just don't realize how difficult it is to raise money. It's extremely difficult. And so I couldn't say to you that people don't do those general solicitation methods, because if you went on the internet, you'll see that there's funds that have just simply created a website, and
mm-hmm.
anybody can go, and they do these mass mailings. I don't advise that, and I don't think that is either successful or that it meets the requirements of this private offering exemption. I prefer to have a closed list of investors that are targeted based on the principal's knowledge of them or prior experience. And and what we would do is assist the fund with sending out, with non-disclosure type documents, these offering documents to the particular investors. And we have a list of who are the potential investors, and we also track the documents that go out with codes and numbers, and so we know how many went out and who got which document, and so we could answer the questions, if ever raised by the securities authorities, as to whether this was a general solicitation. I think once you start getting into a general solicitation, it's you're acting more like a broker or underwriter versus doing a private offering, and so you could blow the exemption. So I don't recommend, advise, or like getting into that at all. But
okay.
There are people that do it.
So and what that would mean
just to get back to that, you can have evenings where you invite people, but the way I've done this with clients is we're inviting a targeted list of people, and we know who's there. It's not a general solicitation of, like you suggested, all dentists in the area.
Right. Right. So I'm just kind of going over some notes as we've been talking. So the difference between a private solicitation and a general solicitation involves additional or some licensing. Is that what it would? Is that what were the big difference between the two?
It does. It involves licensing. It does. Yes, it can involve licensing, but also. The private offering exemption says that you are making an investment to a certain number of accredited investors, and you're certifying that whatever you disclose to the accredited investors, you're going to disclose to the non-accredited investors, and the securities authorities do not have to approve your document. But you do file with them the fact that you are making this private offering. They don't have to approve it. They don't get to change the language or put restrictions on it and all the things that they do when it's becoming a public offering and it's a prospectus. So if you do blow that exemption and they consider it to be a public offering, then you've got a whole other animal on your hands.
Okay.
And so
is this like the Dewey or what the I forget the name of the law, but it's when an investment turns into a security, and then you've got this is when you cross the line.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't know. Backing up, if you look at these sites and people that do these general solicitations,
sure. Yep.
They will put out a basic website which tells you things and then asks you to click another button or give them your information, and then they'll send you out offering documents. So
right.
So it's not as if there's this website with these offering documents just being displayed over the internet. They have,
right.
They're going to be trying to say they've got control over who they're sending these documents out to, because they requested them and they did it based on the website. But it's hard enough to raise money. And the way that I see it is that the investors are investing in the principles of the fund.
Right.
They're basically backing those people based on some kind of knowledge of their track record or trust factor. So I just believe that the success rate in just generally soliciting out there is not going to be high. And those investors that you get in that that have no real relationship or knowledge might be burdensome.
Right.
In terms of management and information communication and things like that. So I would really recommend not doing that.
And what about compensating people for bringing capital to the table? Like, for example, for whatever reason, I happen to know, a number of wealth managers, people who deal with wealthy individuals and their estates, planning their estates and, managing their money and that sort of a thing. Can you reach out to those people and they can reach out to their people? And if so, can they be compensated for being in the middle? How does that work?
Yes, they can. You can reach out to them. They then do reach out to their people. They can be compensated. Once again, it's a disclosure issue.
Okay.
So in your offering documents, you need to be telling investors specifically the source and uses of funds. And this is where potential fund principals kind of lose it, because they just disclose the business idea that they have. In other words, I went out and bought 10 foreclosed homes and I made X dollars off them. So this is my financial projections. I buy a home for X, I rehab it for Y, and then I sell it for this. I'm making 20%, but under the law, you have to disclose how all these funds are being used. So if you are going to be compensating people to bring investors in, you need to disclose that in the document so the investors know. And the form that you file with the SEC is called a Form D. Regulation D is the statute, so it's a Form D which matches that. And on that, you're saying whether or not you're going to be employing people or giving them a commission to raise the funds. But once again, you can't do it, but everybody has to know about it.
Okay. So if I'm the principal in the fund, I mean, really, ideally, the way this goes is I make sure that I have a solid plan or process or source of desirable product that I am confident I can get some returns on. I reach out to I put my own money, and then I reach out to friends and family and business associates who I think might be interested in and capable of investing. And then as a third round, I could look to work with other professionals, it sounds like probably licensed professionals, who would also have those connections who could invest. But I really wouldn't want to run an ad in the Boston Globe on Sundays that says, like, you know, now forming, you know, just a fund, go to buynotescheap.com and we'll, you know, to download a package, right?
Exactly. Exactly,
okay.
And that's how I guide clients through it. It's kind of a stacking procedure. First of all, your own skin in the game, and then friends and family, and then colleagues, and so on.
Okay.
So you build it up like that. Yeah.
Cool. So I think we've talked about, I've got a few points here. How do the different legal or structures or other structures impact who can invest with you and how you can market or solicit? I think we covered that pretty thoroughly. Is there anything you want to add to that piece?
Well, you had asked me a question before we started this. What happens when an investor wants out?
Oh, yes.
And I think that's important because this goes to the accredited investor or the sophistication or the appropriateness of the investment. I think that in these funds, these are illiquid investments. And
right.
If it's a note purchase, there's going to be a period of time where you're negotiating with the banks. And based on the way that I see it, a lot of times it's some kind of a portfolio of notes that they're going to want to sell. Sometimes they want to stick you with some of the notes that are less well-performing, and they'll give you the deal in that way. So you're going to have a certain inventory that you need to then market, reposition, get out in the market, sell, recoup the funding, You're going to have to invest in facilities or software or personnel, and so all of this takes time. So I think that the disclosure, the offering documents need to disclose that there's a certain time cycle, that it may be 5 years, and during those 5 years, you're not going to get any money back. You will get your reports, and you'll be fully informed of your investment, but the investment won't be able to perform if there's distributions to investors, and I think that should really be clearly brought out in the document.
So that's so, in that case, one of the other things that I'm seeing out there, and so I just want to make sure that we clarify this, because some of the people that I know who are buying notes are really doing it. Sometimes they're buying performing. Sometimes they are buying non-performing, but they're renegotiating or doing workouts. And so there's a matter of there's still a cash flow and amortization of the assets that they buy. And so then in that case, would you are you paying dividends back to your
yes.
investors? Okay.
Yes,
and how would you recommend doing that? Are you doing that on a monthly or quarterly? What would you recommend for how that would work?
I would think quarterly. I think monthly might be too much.
Yeah.
Too much administration. What I said before is as to the investor's principal. I think it should be stated that investor principal is going to be illiquid
for the
term of the fund.
Right.
And distributions, yes. And I would recommend that the fund does that, either on a quarterly, twice a year or annual basis. So that should be done.
Okay. What else do I have here on my list? Let's see. I have a couple of things. So I'm going to save number five for last, I think. Let me ask you one more thing about sourcing funds. I know some folks here up at Pensco Trust. I don't know if you do. Have you ever heard of them? Warren, they're a local. When I say local, they're I guess they're regional. They're out of New Hampshire or something, but they do alternative IRAs. You know, where you're not putting them in stocks and that kind of a thing. It's a self-directed IRAs. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And so what I wanted to ask you about is in terms of finding people with funds, could people use IRA funds or, you know, something, some other funds other than just cash that they have, you know, in the bank?
Yes, they can use those. I think from what I've seen, the IRA, which is the pre-tax funds, can be used. The Roth type IRA funds cannot be used.
Okay.
As far as I know. And then we've tried to deal with a situation where an investor has 1031 funds, and that's very, very difficult. And it's rare because of the timeline, but it is possible. But I guess the answer to your question is, yes, IRA money could be used. I've seen it done.
Okay. So I have been involved in a number of exchanges in my career, but it was always real estate for real estate, you know, straight up.
Right.
I'm selling this. I've owned it for 25 years, and I'm not paying taxes,
right.
You know, damn it, and I'm gonna exchange it. So you're saying that it is possible but difficult to get that into a fund and that would still qualify, or would it – because I know – and I'm sort of ramble on a little bit here. There was the TICs for a while, right, which are not unlike
right.
what we're talking about. I know that totally
right.
imploded. But is this – so is it a similar sort of – tell me about that.
It is. It's just that the structure would have to be around the 1031 funds, and all okay. other money would have to fit into that because of the fact that because of the limitation on the assets that you can invest in. But there is an IRS section, and I may get it wrong. I think it's 761, but if you follow,
I'm not going to check, Warren.
Okay. It's very detailed disclosures and how it gets split up. So the whole fund would have to be structured around this 1031 money, and I don't think that's going to happen, not unless it's making up a bulk of it.
Okay. And so I know this is kind of wandering off into some other territory, so maybe we don't even want to talk about this, but I know, you know, the 1031, obviously it's like kind assets, right? So,
right.
So in this case, and I don't mean to be putting your 1031 knowledge to the test. I know you're not, I don't know, but I didn't think that was sort of your main thing, but, is a debt instrument, is a loan or a note? That's not equivalent to a property, is it, in an exchange? Because I'm not really buying property, I'm buying the debt on a property. Is that accurate, or do you think it could be argued that if I sell my an actual piece of real estate, I could buy a real estate note with that money?
No.
I
wouldn't be comfortable answering it definitively.
Yep. All right, we'll dodge that one. we'll silo that one. We'll come back to it in a future call. Okay. So I know that go ahead.
No, I think that there's certain things that are specifically excluded, and limited partnership interest may be one of them, because I did have a potential a client who had done a 1031 and actually wanted to go into a tax credit investment, which wasn't possible. And I remember from that research that I think the limited partnership or interest in corporations weren't like kind. But does that mean that an interest in a note falls into that? I wouldn't know without looking into it in detail.
Okay, right, because I guess you're not actually investing in the notes. You're investing in shares in the partnership that's investing in the notes.
Yes, and that's where the 761 comes in. I don't know. I wouldn't want to talk about this one.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good lawyerly response to a question like that, I think. Are there any like actual client issues or questions that you've seen in the past that you've dealt with, or you know, things that I might not have brought up that you want to touch on or talk about?
Well, I think just specifically. Not specifically, on a more general level, the issues that I see are that I tend to work on a lot more documents than actually than deals that actually get closed and funded. So I'm not saying that these deals never get closed and funded, but we do work with clients where we are drafting up the offering documents, and they don't seem to have realized how difficult it is to raise the money. Mm-hmm. Or they go about it in a way that dooms the project. Sometimes I've worked for a client who spent so much time on the documents and getting them absolutely perfect that the window with the potential investors closed. So there's an argument here that you need to strike the right balance. You need to make sure you're complying, putting out a good document. But honestly, if there's a window of opportunity with these things, and you have to strike during that period of time. I think that maybe it's a sophistication level. I've had to work with clients that that had a very good idea, but it was but the fund idea was not what their background had been.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as much as we tried to structure the documents, and in those types of situations, I would put in a board of advisors of more professional people within the asset class of what the fund's trying to do. But that's a very tough sell. So specifically or generally, those are kind of the issues that I see.
Okay, that does help. And so sort of, you know, I guess to tie this off, we talked a lot about the structure and sort of how and a lot of the workings of it. So I think we've talked about where to set it up. And so finally, I mean, these are legal documents. I know, you prepare them. You know, what should somebody expect to be investing in just getting set up to be able to do all the stuff that we've talked about?
Okay. I would call this the document or the documentation phase of the fund. So the creation of the documents themselves, it depends not really on the size of the deal, but on the structure and the complexity and the level of detail and work that needs to go into fleshing out the financial projections and things like that. If you have a client that is hiring accounting professionals, it will make it easier. If you have a client that is trying to do it themselves or trying to have some of that work be done by the lawyers, it's going to make it more costly and probably slow the process down. But as a ballpark, I would think that these the documentation would cost somewhere around $10,000, and it could be as much as 25, maybe even 30 or 35,000 on a much larger deal.
Okay.
I think that would probably be the range.
Cool. So, I mean, this has been really helpful for me. I've had a number of these questions that I've been walking around thinking about, and so I really appreciate you coming on and giving me an opportunity to ask them. And is there anything that you want to leave folks with, or can I tell them how to find you?
Yes, please.
Where would you like them to go?
The website is cherrytree-group.com.
And Cherry Tree is one word.
Cherry Tree is one word, yeah.
Yep.
Our phone number is 617-431-2266. And we're in Newton, Mass., 233 Needham Street, Newton, Mass. My email is Warren, W-A-R-R-E-N, at cherrytree, which is one word, cherrytree-group.com.
Okay. Well, that's great, Warren.
And, thank you.
I really, really appreciate you coming on, and this will be an excellent addition. It's just so timely, and really answers a lot. This is it's like a little mini course right here, all wrapped up into an hour of chatting. So, thanks a lot for coming on, and really hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.